Three, two, one.
So a boundary is an expectation or parameter that you set with yourself or with another person. Boundaries can be physical, they can be verbal, and they can be actions. I think sometimes when we set boundaries, we only think about communicating boundaries, but we can also exercise boundaries in our behaviors. Gaslighting is when people try to convince you that something is your fault when it is not, or when they try to convince you that the problem is you and not them, or that the problem is something else and not them. It is a protective strategy to not be at fault for self.
If you're in a place where you need a little extra therapy, maybe you can't afford therapy right now, or you're just looking for that daily affirmation, Nedra Glover Tawab is the person to follow. She's a New York Times best-selling author, licensed therapist, and a heavily sought-after relationship expert. She's practiced relationship therapy for 14 years and is the founder and owner of the group therapy practice Kaleidoscope Counseling. Every day, she helps people, including myself, create healthy relationships by teaching them how to implement boundaries. Her philosophy is this: a lack of boundaries and assertiveness underlie most relationship issues, and helping people create healthy relationships with themselves and other is key. She's recently published a book called Set Boundaries, Find Peace that has just been an incredible gift to give to yourself and to others. I can't wait for us to delve in. We focus a lot on boundaries, and I focus a lot more on gaslighting, since that is something that I have been really trying to learn more about and dealing with on a personal level. So thank you, Nedra Tawab, for this amazing guided storytelling session and maybe therapy session as well. I know that you all will benefit so much from this, and I hope you enjoy. Welcome, welcome to our guided storytelling session, Nedra. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
I always open up our conversations by doing a heart check-in and asking you, how is your heart today?
After some morning meditation and reading, journaling, my heart is good.
You just named all of the main ingredients that you need for a really good morning that I should have done this morning but did not do. And I know that exactly those three things that if I get a chance to do them, I'm feeling 100 times better. How did you come up with that routine for yourself?
Well, I noticed that I was starting the day just feeling hurried and not in tune with myself. And so I started this practice maybe 2 years ago, just waking up and reading, journaling, tapping into myself before moving on with my day. And even sometimes when the morning routine is a little reduced, I try to come back to it at some point in the day to just have that time to myself. And it does really help.
I've noticed that when I'm feeling really scattered in the morning, for me, morning pages or journaling is what clears it. And if I don't get a chance to do that, that scattery noise will still be there. But if I do it even midday, like the impact is still there to kind of just clear your head. Is that how it is for you?
Absolutely. I've been reading this journal, and they give you like, think about this during the day. And the other day I was like, throw this whole day in the trash. And then I thought about that thing that they said, think about. And I was like, you know what? I can do this. You know, I started affirming myself. So it really did help me get through the difficult parts of the day. So I just feel different when I'm able to have those moments to myself. I don't feel as like anxious or worried or moved by anything that I'm unable to control. It's like I'm kind of easy breezy when I'm able to have that time to myself.
And of course, as a therapist, as someone who is constantly in service for other people, it must be incredibly hard to kind of navigate and balance that time for yourself and still giving that time for others. I was having a conversation with my brother about therapists and how it's always great to talk to a therapist because you are giving them your load instead of giving it to a loved one who might not be able to carry it because there's such a personal attachment, or if mm-hmm. they do carry it, they internalize it. Mm-hmm. And I'm so curious to know, how do therapists do that? How do you do that? And can you do that? Can you completely separate yourself from your clients and other people who are sharing such heavy things with you?
For the most part, yes, because I know that I am doing my best work in that time that I'm with my clients, and I've given them the tools, we've worked through some things, and I have to allow them to do the work. It's very different, like you said, than with a personal relationship where likely you're tied into the other people in their life, right? Mm-hmm. With my clients, I only know them. I don't really know, you know, these other folks. I may know, you know, them by name, but I don't know them energetically. I don't know them in spirit. But when you're talking to your friend and she's talking about her boyfriend and you've hung out with the both of them, you know, that's a very different dynamic than what a therapist does. So it is a lot easier to have very clear boundaries and just, you know, be in that space with them and leave them. And I will say there are times when you do carry a bit of folks' stories, not in a, you know, I don't carry it in an anxious or worried way, but sometimes during a week I will say, huh, I wonder what did so-and-so decide, or I wonder what happened with this thing. And, you know, I just wait until I see them again the next week and I find out. So it's, you know, these fleeting moments of thought, you know, we're humans, we do think about people. And I share that with them sometimes. The other day I was watching so-and-so and I thought of you and your situation with this thing. Because, you know, the mind does wander, and it does wander to the people that you have spent time with, and that's normal. But there is a distinction between being a therapist who listens to people talk about, you know, problems or things they're going through, what they need help with, and then listening to a friend or family member do that same sort of work. Mm-hmm. So therapy, I think sometimes is much easier to listen to people's problems because, you know, they're there to get help. And I think sometimes with our friends and family, they aren't looking for help. They're just simply trying to vent. And like you said, sometimes we don't have the emotional capacity to be of service to them in those moments.
Why is it so important for people who are dealing with these built up experiences, emotions, things that they haven't really processed, to find a professional person to talk to, a therapist, rather than go to family and friends? And is there a better time to go to family and friends rather than to go to a therapist? How does that dynamic work?
Yeah, I think it depends on how we're talking about things. Sometimes we do just need to vent, particularly when something just happened. We may want to get it off our chest and a friend is, you know, available, accessible. But to really process those things, it needs to be done with a therapist, because many of our friends and family, they have the same or sometimes worse tools than what we have. And so they're not even able to help us with some of this stuff. It's like you're asking your friend who's in debt about financial stuff. You know, it's like, you know, perhaps you should be talking to an accountant. You know, we have to be willing to pay for the things that we need. We have to be willing to seek help outside of the people who we think should know everything, because our friends and family, they are not experts in anxiety and depression and coping skills. They have those struggles as well. And sometimes they can impart some information that's really helpful. And of course, they can be there for you in those moments when you're needing support. But there is a distinction. And I think that it damages our relationships when people come to us for therapy. And when I say therapy, I mean like, give me the answers. What do I do? I need advice. What? That is very taxing on a relationship when you are the decision maker for someone, or when you have to constantly help them get through these things or advise them. That's when we know, oh my gosh, my friend, my cousin, my whoever, they need to seek some therapy and maybe not be speaking to me about these issues, because it's starting to impact me. It's starting to impact how I interact with them, or, you know, how I feel after the phone call.
I love how you say how I feel after the phone call, because I've been in that position several times. I'm still sometimes in that position. And I think part of the resentment that I end up feeling is, as an empath especially, you may have vented and feel better, but now I have this anxiety that I'm dealing with because you left me with this lingering thing. Mm-hmm. And my problem, I guess, with the boundary that I need to set is not trying to do all the mathematics and logistics around trying to fix someone or control what they're going to do in assuming that I'm trying to help them. When someone does receive that dump, how do you suggest one go about setting a boundary and not thinking about it for the rest of the day or the rest of the week, or trying to come up with solutions and constantly trying to fix a situation?
Yeah, I think sometimes the boundary is letting people know that you can't handle what they're sharing with you. And I've been in a situation where I've told somebody that, like, I cannot listen to you talk about this issue in this way. Like, it is taxing on me. And the person said, well, I just feel like you should listen. And I'm like, yeah, I can't. And so, you know, we continue to have, and they would continue. And I'm like, I can't do it. It's too much. And I tried to, I'll talk to them less. I'll do these things. But they refuse to respect the boundary of, I can't, like, this is too much. Like, this is like, you need to be speaking to a professional about this level of an issue. And ultimately, I had to decide what to do. Do I want to continue a relationship with a person who won't respect the boundary and who's clear that they won't respect it because they think I should just not have the boundary? And that's really tough. But it was impacting my ability to function after interactions with him, to really be able to get back within my day. I'm like replaying the conversation, like, what? Maybe, you know, like all of these things. And it's like, this is having a huge emotional toll on me. And this is not even my stuff.
And for you, you are a professional, but in that situation, they're not respecting that you cannot therapize someone you have a relationship with.
Yes.
That is unethical. And also, are you inevitably going to have that therapist hat on and you're battling between the two roles in that moment?
I don't think I was playing therapist, but I think just naturally, it's easy for people to talk to me. And so sometimes even when I say, I don't want to talk about this, people are like, but you're so easy to talk to, because I am. You know, therapy training helped me a bit, but, you know, I'm usually like, well, you know, you want to wear, you wear, you know, like, I'm like, you know, I'm cheering you on. I'm open. So I get it. I am, you know, not a hard person to share deep things with, but I don't always want to hear deep things. Sometimes I just want to be at the party. Like, oh my gosh, when do I relax? You know, it's like, I want downtime. Like, I could, you know, I am committed to helping others. And so in personal relationships, it's important to have that balance of, we are present in this moment and not always in your stuff. And when it starts to spill over to, we are always in your stuff, and I set a clear boundary, you know, I have to think about, you know, how do I want to conduct myself in this relationship? That is the really hard work of boundaries. What we like people to do is just respect them. I would like that too. I would love to be able to tell people, like, please don't talk to me about that anymore. And they just say, okay. And they actually do it. Sometimes that works.
So there's obviously so many things we can go into with what you just said, with your experience and the process of setting boundaries. When I first started learning about boundaries in such a clear context, which was from you and from my friend Vera Papisova, who introduced me to you, I remember immediately thinking, okay, this sounds great. And at the same time, whoever I would like to set boundaries with is going to take it personal and going to say, you don't care about me, you don't love me, like, who do you think you are? And get really upset, because when you set a boundary with someone who doesn't have boundaries themselves, it's really hard for you to explain, this is something I'm doing for me. This is not because of you. It's not about you. It's something that I have to do, because you're not even taking into account all of the stuff that I go through that you don't know about. And so you don't know what my capacity is. And also, you don't want them to think that it is hindering on your affection and love for and care for them. But immediately, especially when you are setting boundaries, I think that that's like the first response that you're typically going to get.
I don't think in all cases. I think it definitely depends on a relationship. I find that with family, it is extremely difficult to set boundaries.
Yeah.
And that is because they have an idea of who you need to be with them. If you're a daughter, they have a certain idea of what daughters are like. If you're a son, they have a certain idea of sons, cousins, sisters, brothers, all of these things. They have an idea of how you should act. So when you say things like, you know, I'm a mom too, and I want to spend Mother's Day in this way, it's like, no, daughters don't do that. And so there is this like, well, you can't have a boundary with me. And it's like, actually, I can. And I understand, you know, that you may not like this boundary, but I am entitled to have boundaries. You're trying to set a boundary with me and you're entitled to have that boundary. It sounds like we don't agree on the boundaries. I'm going to go with my boundary because that's what I want right now. I think that there are people who absolutely take boundaries personally. I've taken boundaries personally. It's a part of being a human. We don't like all rules. We don't, you know, when people say any rule, it's like, yes, I think they make sense, but I don't want them to apply to me. You know, it's like, okay, I understand that Target closed at 9, but why can't it stay open to 9:30 when I need it to be open? You know,
right.
it's one of those things.
Is Target setting a boundary with us? Is that what happens?
Target needs to set lots of boundaries for us because most people go wild in Target. But
that's so funny. Well, before even having this discussion, the thing that keeps flashing in my head is, we need to clarify how we define boundaries, because to a person who doesn't know about emotional boundaries the way that we're talking about, a boundary looks like a physical barrier to keep one person from another person. And I think that redefining what we know as boundaries for one another can also help us physically visualize it in a more accessible way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so a boundary is an expectation or parameter that you set with yourself or with another person. Boundaries can be physical, they can be verbal, and they can be actions. I think sometimes when we set boundaries, we only think about communicating boundaries, but we can also exercise boundaries in our behaviors. So for example, if you are setting a boundary with yourself around finances, that might look like not shopping online. That is a behavior. That's nothing you need to say to yourself, or, you know, that is a behavioral boundary that you're setting. A verbal boundary might be saying to someone, hey, before you stop by, I need you to give me a call before you come. That could be a verbal boundary. So there are so many ways to set boundaries. And even with that one, you know, that's a pretty common boundary that I talk about with people. And people do get upset. Why can't I just pop up at your house? I shouldn't have to call before I come. I'm your mom. I'm your aunt. I'm your sister. I'm your brother. I should be able to come. And it's like, well, it's my house. And I like to be prepared. I don't like to just jump off the couch and open the door for people. I want to, you know, maybe clean my house, take a nap, like, you know, I want to be prepared. So I get it. Boundaries are personal. They are personal, but they are not meant to be offensive in many cases. It's actually meant to be a safety precaution for self. It's meant to be a self-care practice for self. It is not meant to harm other people. If my self-care practice is taking a shower and straightening up before people come over, you can help me do that by giving me a call before you come over.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not, you know, I understand that you want to be the special person in my life that could just pop up whenever they want to, but that doesn't work for me. Please don't do that to me. And there could be other people in your life who don't mind it, but I'm saying that I do.
I think that's the biggest thing. So many of us see people on the same plane. Well, if this person can handle it, why couldn't you? And we have this comparison. We overcompare within ourselves, mm-hmm. with ourselves, and with other people. Well, so-and-so did this. Well, so-and-so looks like this. Well, so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. And in our heads, we write this wild story that everybody had the same exact life and upbringing and has the same exact experiences and personal dilemmas that they're going through. What is a great way that you suggest people gain perspective without making things about themselves?
I think to respect boundaries, you have to have boundaries. And that makes it easier for you to understand the importance of them. You mentioned that earlier, that it's hard to set boundaries with people who don't have boundaries. That's absolutely true, because they will always see it as offensive that someone is trying to set an expectation with them. And so, you know, sometimes I will say that, gosh, I look really bad setting a boundary because nobody else has boundaries with this person. It's like they're letting them do everything. And when I say something like, you know, you can't do this to me, it's like, what? Because everybody else is letting them do it. And everybody else has a problem with it. But nobody is saying anything. I remember a time when I was in this friend group and everybody would talk about this one person in the friend group. And I said something directly to the person like, hey, you know, this thing doesn't work for me. And it was like, oh, I can't believe you said anything to her. And I'm like, everybody is already talking about her. Like, I'm so confused. Why don't we just request this thing that we have a big issue with? Like, I just came into the issue. I'm just going to mention it as protocol for operating with me. You all have an issue with it. You pretend not to, which is a porous boundary. That is, you actually have an issue. You're just not saying anything to the person. So that is a boundary issue. When a healthy boundary is to say, hey, you show up late to this thing or whatever it is, and I would like you to be a little more prompt. Say that to the person instead of whispering, oh my gosh, she said again, you know, all of this stuff. It's like, be direct. Be direct.
Be direct.
If that's what you want.
Yeah. And also in your story and example, having a group of people talk about another person, I think that was something that, you know, even from high school, I felt really, really uncomfortable with. And now looking back, I never had the courage to say something. I just distanced myself from the group of people who did that. But as you get older, there's family and there's friend groups and there's colleagues. So how do you, especially with people that you love and respect, set a boundary around what you talk about and who you talk about and the way that you talk about them? And how do you also reinforce that boundary when it's such a habit that they don't even really think about?
Well, you can't change people. And the only thing you can change in situations is yourself. So if you've said to someone two or three times, you know, hey, I prefer if you not talk about this person like that, and they continue to do it, now you have a choice to make. This person is not respecting your boundary. What is the consequence? I think often we think we're supposed to like keep going back to the person and asking for the thing that they're unwilling to do. They're not willing to do it. They're showing you. They're continuing to operate in a way you're asking them not to operate in. What do you do? This is the hard part. What is the consequence?
Can you tell us if you remember the first time you set a boundary or at least felt the need to, and you were trying to navigate what that feeling was?
I don't remember the first time I set a boundary, but I remember some early boundaries. I don't remember the first time I set a boundary. If I could go back in a time machine, I'd love to hear myself saying, don't do it, whatever, I don't know. But my journey of setting boundaries very clearly in my head began when I was in high school. And I remember making requests, asking for things, not apologizing to people who harmed me. That was one of my boundaries that I set in high school. Because
how did you know to do that?
You know, my friend asked me this too. She was like, why didn't you feel like things were your fault? And I'm like, because I didn't do anything.
So you just had that clarity at a very young age.
I guess. Like, I remember a situation where I had a family member, like, blatantly, like, have this like anger outburst towards me. And then they didn't call me after this thing. And they called me a year later and was like, yeah, because you made me go off on you. And I'm like, I didn't do anything.
Like, they called you 1 year later? Like,
yeah, yeah. They, you know, that I think because I refused to apologize. That was my first, that is my first memory of refusing to apologize to a person who harmed me.
You know not to apologize because you didn't do anything.
I didn't do anything.
And how do you not feel that anger? Because I've been in a situation like that. It literally physically overwhelms my entire body. And I'm just like, well, they should be calling me. They should be apologizing to me. Oftentimes what'll happen is people won't apologize. They'll just pretend like it didn't happen. I think that that's something that I'm very familiar with, is this outburst, no accountability, pretend like it didn't happen. And then everybody does, because nobody wants to go through that again, because it's really, they're traumatic experiences. And it really takes a toll. And it's really, I think, triggering. And then the next time it does happen, your bodily reaction is so overwhelming because it's still suppressed everything else that happened because no accountability was taken.
Yeah. And that's the piece that I'm not here for. I'm not here for people rewriting history to fit what actually happened. I'm not innocent in everything. There are some times where I do things to people and I typically apologize. I'm quick to apologize and be like, oh my gosh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do this. My mom, she would be like, you are too honest, because my mom would say, okay, you have to, your company has to leave at 9 o'clock, right? And she might come downstairs and they're still there at 10:30. And she was like, why didn't they leave? I'm like, 'cause you fell asleep. It's like, you didn't put, like, I was just honest. Like, okay, yeah, I did it. What's the consequence? You know, did you skip school today? Yes, I did. I'm like, if you ask me, you already know the answer. And I don't want to put you through the loops of trying to figure out the truth when it seems like you know the truth. So just tell me my punishment and I can live with that.
It seems like it saves you so much time.
It saves you so much time. And, you know, I have an older sister, and I saw like the dynamic of, I was there with my mom when she was trying to figure out these pieces. And I'm like, ooh, your punishment is actually worse if she has to like figure out stuff. And so my takeaway was, just be honest, no matter what you do, right? Just say, yes, I did it, apologize, do whatever. And the consequence is just much easier. And that was, you know, it was the truth. Like, my worst punishment was a week without the telephone. That's the worst punishment I ever received. And it was very effective because I love to talk on the telephone. So with that, when people are doing things, they gossip about you, they have an anger outburst, they betray you in some way. When those things happen, I don't think that those things are my fault, because there is no evidence that they are. And what the other person is trying to do is gaslight me. I didn't know the word was gaslighting.
I've only learned that word recently too.
I didn't know that word, you know, 15 years ago, but that's what it was. And it is still is. People, you know, continue. Instead of just being accountable, I had a situation recently where someone was just trying to make all these other things the issue. And it was like, this is gaslighting. Like, I'm not.
Can you define gaslighting for our listeners in case they don't know?
Yeah. So gaslighting is when people try to convince you that something is your fault when it is not, or when they try to convince you that the problem is you and not them, or that the problem is something else and not them. And I think people do that. It is a protective strategy to not be at fault for stuff. When you don't want to be accountable, sometimes it is easier to say that it wasn't my fault. It's this other thing. And it's like, it was you. Like, you know, it's kind of like driving a car, looking at a map and getting the directions wrong. And then you highlight to a person like, hey, we're going the wrong way. It wasn't my fault. It was the map. But you were reading the map. Like, you're reading the map. Like, you know, just acknowledge it, like, oh my gosh, I got us off course. But when you say it's not you, It's like, well, who was it? I think sometimes with gaslighting, I don't think people know they're doing it, but I receive it as a cruel behavior. I do. I receive that as a cruel behavior because you are trying to convince a person that their thinking is not real.
It's such a common behavior, especially now with the internet. It is even more of a common behavior, but I think it's a lot deeper of a problem when it's in your personal relationships. Hi there. If you find our work beneficial and you want to support how we build our company at your service, you can subscribe to my Patreon at patreon.com/nor. It's usually personal writings, and as I build a community on there, hopefully more. Your support is how we build. I also curate a weekly newsletter of all the things I'm benefiting from and enjoying that week. Anything from what I'm reading, watching, listening, buying, and more. Like most things, I keep it personal. You can subscribe to it at nortagori.com/newsletter. Now back to the story. When you are therapizing someone who you know is a gaslighter, the one who is committing the gaslighting, how do you guide them in realizing their behavior and giving them also the courage to change that behavior? Because I agree with you, it is a cruel behavior. The feeling that you get when you are being gaslit is trembling. It's such a big, hurtful feeling. And I think my go-to when it happens to like make myself feel better and protect the relationship is they don't know any better. This is how they grew up. This is how they were raised. This is how their own interactions and relationships have been. And it's not my responsibility to change that person, but God, I wish I could help them. And I know that it's not my responsibility to do so because we cannot change people, but you want that healing for them too.
Mm-hmm. They have to want it for themselves. When I think of gaslighting, I think of, you know, all the people I know who believe it was their fault that their house burned down, but they were unsupervised and playing with fire, you know, or they believe it was their fault that they were sexually assaulted because they didn't say no. Or because they went to this thing with this person, or they did, you know, all of these things where it's like people will really make you believe that things are your fault. You know, I even think of like, you know, someone breaking in your car. And I remember one time I was in college and someone broke in my car and stole my books. And the first question someone asked was, were your doors locked? And I said, no one should go in your car. Unlocked doors, locked doors. Nobody should go in your car. I've never opened a stranger's car. That's against the law, whether your door is locked or not. Now, of course, having the door open makes it easier, but I already feel bad if somebody has gone in my car. You don't have to make me feel worse by telling me it's my fault.
Why is it so easy for us to put blame on other people?
Control. We think we can control everything. You know, that's why we do most of the, we're trying to control everything. And if we could have did this, then this wouldn't have happened. And if this would have, you know, it's like, well, maybe they would have just bust your window out and went in your car. Like, I don't know. We can't control every aspect of a situation. And I think we blame others because that's what we're trying to do. And anything that I've done wrong, like, you know, or anything that has happened to me, trust me that I've already ran through the list in my head. You do not need to ask me, did I do this or did I think about this? It's like, yeah, I probably did. So just support me because I've already ran through how I contributed to this thing.
Is this still difficult for you at times?
Doing the work?
Yeah.
Of course. You know, I think doing the work is a life practice. And I can't imagine a time, a day, or a moment where I will not be applying some principles of peace because it is constant. It is constant, but it is very rewarding. I think I feel much better being able to set boundaries to, even when it's hard. You know, you asked me a question a little bit ago that I didn't answer. And you said, what do I do when I am in therapy with someone and they are a gaslighter? The truth of it is, I don't know that they're a gaslighter because I'm getting their side of the story. Now, how would I know that this is not the truth? I think there has been a few occasions, and I've been a therapist for 14 years, and I maybe a handful of occasions where I thought this person is being dishonest. Only a handful. I've seen hundreds of people, and I probably have five where I can say they were being, they that was dishonest, right? And it could be, I don't know, maybe it's half. I don't know. I'm only getting one side of the story. And so I'm not a character in their life. So I don't know. In my personal relationships, I do know because I know the other, I know what they're saying to me and how it impacts me. I know the other characters in their life. As a therapist, I don't know. And you can tell me these things and I'm going to be on your side because I believe you.
When you have a gaslighter in your personal life that who you care about, how do you approach that situation outside of setting your own boundaries? Is there anything you can do to help this person, or is it 100% not your responsibility?
How do we help people with things that they don't want to help, want help with, or things that they don't see as an issue?
Is it possible?
What do you think?
I think if we're using the example of gaslighting, and like you mentioned earlier, most people, when they're gaslighting, they don't know they're doing it. And then you sit someone down and you define it, and then you tell that person that this is what I feel like you're doing. And their most likely response is going to be, no, I'm not. That's not what I'm doing. And then they'll go somewhere else. So I guess maybe you can't do anything about it, but
yes.
So what do you do with your insides when you know for sure you can't do anything about it, but you still feel this hurt?
Be hurt. You just be hurt and you decide what you want to do with the relationship. There are some people who gaslight, but they do it so infrequently, it doesn't even bother me, right? And there are some people who constantly gaslight and it's like, this is intolerable. This is intolerable to consistently So for me, it depends on the severity. If it's someone, I think maybe most of us gaslight at some point, right? If you gaslight me once a year, maybe I could get past that. If you gaslight me four times a month, that might be a little problematic for me. Like that's a continuous, regular process of gaslighting. And then, you know, if you're four times a month is once a week. So I'm in my head for like the whole week and then you're back the next week with some more. I can't live in that chaos. That is my choice to not live in that sort of relationship chaos. And, you know, I think we can decide how we want to be in relationship with people. Maybe we only want to talk to some people once a month or, you know, once a week if we were talking to them every day or on holidays or, you know, you can decide what you can handle. I don't know that. I don't think we can convince people that they are something that they aren't in their head. In their head, they aren't this thing. So, you know, one of the therapy strategies that most therapists practice is not telling people who they are. It's just not effective. It's not effective for me to tell my client, you are a gaslighter. They will never accept that. People have to figure out who they are on their own. And that's typically when they accept it. When they start to understand, gosh, I don't have integrity. Gosh, I gaslight people. I manipulate people. That's when they're ready to change it. They're not ready to change it when I tell them, because they don't even see it as a problem. They see that you have a problem, not that they have a problem. And so in telling people you're codependent, you're a gaslighter, you get really angry and you do blah, 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 like telling people about themselves, rarely does it work, rarely. Because people start to see you as the problem.
Which I think is often the case from the beginning too, when you have something to say. a lot of people in our community, young people who are still living with their parents, still living with their families, and don't have an option to not be in that relationship or situation. I get so many questions about this when they're in, whether it be physically, emotionally, mentally abusive households, or whether they just retreat to themselves as much as they can, and then people in their families are like, they just want nothing to do with us. What guidance would you give to people who don't have a choice within their physical boundaries that they can set?
We can set mental boundaries. There are times when we know the capacity of other people, and we have to set boundaries with ourselves about how we can be in relationship with them. For people who are at home and they need to be at home, the best thing I think that you can do if you're in a difficult situation is plan to be an adult and to create a life. What does that look like? That looks like, you know, finding employment, building a support system outside of your family, maybe relying on family members who are healthy for you. You could get away when you're not away yet. And I think that starts by building some very strong relationships at that point that could support you when you're ready and able to leave your family.
Hi, I hope you're enjoying the storytelling session. I just wanted to share something with you. If you're looking for a good deed opportunity these days, my family has been working to alleviate local homelessness for over 10 years. We have a foundation called I See You, and we make care packages for people experiencing homelessness. We make family food bags with food staples and give out grocery gift cards to families in need and more. Everything is done by donation, and 100% of the money goes towards community members in need. If you'd like to donate, you can through Venmo at ISY Foundation or PayPal to contact@isyfoundation.org. If you or someone you know is in need in the DC, Maryland, and Virginia area and could use our help, please DM on Instagram ISY Foundation or shoot us an email. Now back to our story. One of the things that you have taught me that is really, really encouraging is when you are scared to set a boundary, when you are nervous to set a boundary because you think that it is going to hurt yourself or hurt other people, remembering that you setting a personal boundary actually gives people courage and permission to do it for themselves. And so when you are scared to do it, you're teaching people also that they can do this for themselves too. That's how I learned about boundaries, when my friend set a casual one once and I was like, whoa, you can say that? You can ask for that? Mm-hmm. And it feels really weird at first, but then you think about it, and the ideal world is one where people are just really clear and direct with what they want and how they feel. So is there anything else that you can guide us with or advise us that you have personally used in the process of gaining courage to set a boundary?
You know, I use my energy as a guide. And what I mean by that is we are often in situations where we may feel discomfort, frustration, resentment, a difficult feeling. And when I feel that, I know that I probably need to set a boundary in that particular area. And it is not easy to do that. I mean, sometimes I've set boundaries that I've had to say it or text it, and I'm like, I cannot believe I did that. Like, my stomach dropped as if I was on a roller coaster because I knew that it would change the course of the relationship. And that's really hard. But I also know that staying in that situation as is will not work. It won't work. It hasn't worked. And I've tried every single thing that I can. And this is the last thing I can do. And so I think when you get to that point of I'm setting this boundary, it's going to be very uncomfortable. You have to just deal with that discomfort, and that is allowing yourself to be sad, you know, moving into, you know, doing morning pages, meditating, surrounding yourself with supportive people, doing things that really build you up after you do this difficult thing, scheduling your therapy appointment and, you know, sharing with your therapist, I did this really hard thing. It is tough setting boundaries. And I don't, you know, sometimes it's easier to set some with some people. And it's just, you know, we know the people in our lives who, if you set a boundary with them, it's like the ultimate offense to say, you know, whatever you need to them, because they feel like you should be needless. And my thing is, you know, when people say, I want you to be happy, I want you to be well, which is something I think we want for most of our loved ones. If that happiness and wellness includes not having a relationship with you or having one with boundaries, want that for me too.
Why do we run away from our feelings? Why is it so hard to do this kind of work?
It's uncomfortable to feel things. It's a, you know, it's even uncomfortable to be happy. You ever heard somebody say, like, I'm too happy? It's
like, yeah. Like, and when they say that, it's because they feel like something disastrous should happen right afterwards.
Yeah, yeah. It's uncomfortable. And I think a lot of times when we're feeling stuff, we just have to feel. A lot of, you know, a lot of times as a therapist, people will start and say, you know, I'm here to, you know, maybe with grief especially, I'm grieving the loss of my father, I'm grieving the loss of this, and I'm coming for you to help me stop grieving. And I'm like, do you know why we grieve? Because we lost something. And grief is a sign that you love something and you no longer have it. And I can't make you get rid of that feeling. I could sit with you as you grieve. I can help you re-engage in life. I can help you figure out some ways to manage your grief. But I cannot help you get rid of grief. Because you will grieve as long as you need to. And if you try to stop this process, you're going to be grieving even longer. When you try to stop grieving, you can, you know, avoid it. And then what happens 10 years later, you're still grieving about the same thing because you didn't want to grieve it.
And because you never processed it. There's the book, The Body Keeps the Score. And I keep that line, even just the title of that book, kind of ringing in my head, because I think that most people, at least most people that I know, do not believe that trauma is stored in your body. I'm a first-gen kid, and so many people that I know are first-gen kids too, and maybe your parents are still in survival mode sometimes. Maybe it's still like, you just have to move on, you just have to move on, because that is what you had to do to survive, and it's a very hard mentality to let go of, because your self-worth is attached to that. Your value is attached to that. The way that you engage with yourself is attached to that. If you decide now, I'm going to do something about it, then maybe you're terrified that all of the trauma that you suppress is just going to resurface and you're just going to break as a human being. But we are strong enough to handle it. And I don't know if it's important for us to remember everything, but for people who do choose the first step of healing, what advice do you give them and what guidance do you give them so that they know that they can do it?
You know, I know that we can do it because we've done it before. There has been some situation in your life where you have felt something and you have survived feeling that thing. So I think the strength is already in you, and it's just a matter of tapping into it again.
Do you think that we need a decent level of self-worth to recognize that we had that strength before? Because I think oftentimes people will respond to that and not see what they've done as strong.
I don't know if that's a self-worth thing as much as I think we need a level of self-reference. We need to be able to reference who we are and not forget about the courage we've had before. I like to think about, and I talk so much about, us being children. I think childhood is one of the most difficult periods of life, even if you didn't experience trauma, only because you were experiencing so many new things and you didn't even understand it. You didn't even understand it. You didn't know what was happening. Can you imagine being dropped off at kindergarten? How traumatic that must be to just be, you know, like, in class with this, you know, this teacher and these kids. It's like, what is this? You know, so, you know, that's an interesting process. I think of, you know, transitioning from middle school to high school, how big that is, like leaving this community that you knew and going somewhere completely different. You know, we've survived so many things already. And we will continue to survive so many more things.
Thank you for giving value to those experiences and allowing people to have grace for themselves in doing those. It's funny, I'm gonna share a little story about my husband real quick. I hope he's okay with that. He had that experience in kindergarten and he like jokes about it, that he was freaking out going to school. And it's a memory that he has, but it's a joking thing. And now just hearing you say that, like as children, that is so traumatic and you actually overcame that from a very young age. At that time, it's almost a big grief or a big trauma that you're going through, but it's what we needed to kind of be able to handle the things that were going to come, because we're not starting from zero. Even when we lose someone close to us, we're not starting from zero. We have lost before and before and before. And so we are built for this. We are trained for this. And sometimes you just need a guide. Who writes a guide on how to reclaim yourself and set boundaries and find peace? And I am learning that this is a Bible for a lot of people right now, especially during COVID. And one of the things that you talk about that I think is really interesting is the process of setting boundaries with yourself. What does it mean for someone to set boundaries with themselves?
You know, I mentioned the financial one earlier where, you know, your financial boundary with yourself might be no online shopping. I think, you know, sometimes I get a lot of messages on Instagram where people say, my ex keeps calling me. Don't answer. That's the boundary. Like, that is a boundary for you. You can't stop your ex from calling, but you do not have to answer. You could also block them. Also, you could tell them, please do not call me anymore. There are so many things that you can do to be the powerful person in your scenario with other people. We don't like to do that. We like people to just get it. We want the complainer to just one day wake up and stop. We don't ever want to tell them, hey, this is too much for me. When I get off the phone with you, I need a therapy session. You know, we never want to tell them that.
Because we don't want to hurt people's feelings.
Yeah, we unintentionally hurt people's feelings all the time. You know, I think, how do we avoid hurting someone's feelings? Because we never really know what hurts someone's feelings. I remember a friend one time, my husband and we were double dating, her husband, my husband. And they were like, well, you guys get in the front seat because you're shorter. And I just, you know, I just got in the front seat. I didn't think anything of it. And then her husband, when we got out to the restaurant, he apologized to us like, oh my gosh, she was so rude. I'm so embarrassed. She called you guys short. And I said, we are shorter than you. If you're 5'11" and I'm 5'4", I am shorter than you. I don't have a complex about being caught short because it's true in this scenario. You know, I don't feel like I didn't take offense to it. And my husband said he didn't take offense to it. But I thought it was interesting because they thought they were hurting our feelings. And I said, no. And maybe other people would care. That wasn't my thing. Like, I was like, all right, shorter people in the front, you know, like, okay, I'm the short person. You know, I'm like, these are tall people.
Like, it wasn't personal.
It wasn't personal. Like, she was right. She was like, y'all short, y'all. I'm like, okay, yeah, I'm short. Like, you're 5'11". Yeah.
Why do we take everything personally?
Because we're humans. And I think there are other things that I would take personally. It's just not that thing. Like, we all have our stuff. There are some things, you know, I know, like with social media, people talk about like FOMO. And so they'll say like, oh my gosh, I saw my friends doing this and I felt like this. When I see my friends doing stuff, especially in a pandemic, I'm like, thank goodness they didn't invite me. I don't want to go nowhere. You know, save me from saying no.
Yes. Oh my gosh. That's like Elsa Majimbo, her TikToks and her reels, where she's like, you're doing me a favor when you cancel your plans. I was going to do it.
Yes.
It's so funny.
Yes. Like, please don't have anything. Like, and if you do, hey, and sometimes, you know, sometimes I'll, you know, afterwards, like, how was this thing? You know, if my husband goes out and I don't want to go out, I'll say, hey, text me their menu. Like, I don't even want to go. Just text me the menu. All I want is the food. I don't want the interaction. Just bring me a plate back.
I love that.
Y'all wow. have fun. And I will watch Handmaid's Tale.
You have to set boundaries with that show. That is a show we set boundaries with.
Well, I started watching it at the beginning of the pandemic and I turned it off. I was like, I cannot watch this. This is too like relevant.
I have been saying that watching Handmaid's Tale now without the last person in the presidential office feels a lot better, because when we were watching it the last 4 years, it felt like a documentary and not science fiction. And so I would only watch one episode at a time. It's funny. We naturally know how to set boundaries with things that we're like, I can't handle watching. I did a documentary on the sex trade in the US, and during those couple of years, I could only watch cartoons. Like, I couldn't watch anything. People would send me, here's another documentary on trafficking, here's this. And I was like, I'm already doing one. I'm not watching these. And I would feel guilty because I was like, am I not doing enough research? Am I being selfish with just working on my own but not considering watching other people's? And I realized I physically can't do it. Like, it won't let me do my work. So I found through that process and going to therapy for the first time how to set boundaries with my work. I think it's more clear now to set boundaries with work, especially today. But there are some dynamics where it's hard to set boundaries. One of them that I keep thinking of is parents and their children, and parents being afraid for their children's safety and worrying about their children. And my mom has 6 kids and we are always still touching base. I don't live at home, but her go-to line is, you'll know when you're a mom. You'll know when you're a mom. But sometimes I want her heart to ease up because I don't want you hurting yourself or feeling this type of way. And I know it's not just her. It's many mothers, especially mothers that I know. How do you advise people on a dynamic that is so like, you are a part of me physically?
I used to live in Detroit and I grew up, born and raised in Detroit, and I had a house there, and I don't watch much news. I'm just not into the news very much. And my cousin called me and she said, be careful, there's a rapist in your neighborhood. I said, why did you tell me this? And she's like, well, I just want you to be careful. You want me to be scared. Like, I don't even know what I could do outside. I mean, I'm already like hyper vigilant around, like, you know, have your floodlights on if you come in at night, carry your mace. Like, I'm doing all the things I can do as a single woman to be careful. Now I'm on the edge of my seat about a rapist. Like, do not tell me stuff like that. But it was her anxiety trying to like protect me in some way. I'm like, this is just not helpful. Like, if you're anxious, don't tell me about it. Like, maybe say, hey, I'm going to come over here and spend some time with you. I don't know. But telling me to look out for a rapist, like, I was like, what? Like, this is just not helpful. And I think sometimes with parents, with family, they are really like, are you okay? Do you have enough money? Is everything is like, whoa. Text me when you get home. Was everything? It's like, this is like, anxiety is contagious. It literally is. And as people are telling you to worry, you become more worried. You become more hypervigilant. You are now watching for these things that, oh my gosh, I'm driving home. Is somebody going to hit me? And it's so unconscious that it impacts our ability to actually function as well, but it does. And I think you can have boundaries with that too, that I understand that you love me and you care about me, but there's, you know, saying things like this makes me anxious. So even if you're thinking it, please don't say blank, because I want to have a restful evening. I don't want to like get 5 text messages because I didn't call as soon as I got in the house. If I don't call you in 24 hours, please check in then.
And what about on the other end though? How does a parent relieve their anxiety of having these little beings who they are responsible for not feel like they have to control every aspect of their life or just feel controlling over where they are, when they are? Like, did they die because they haven't texted me? Things like that are very extreme in that thought.
Yeah, I think in those situations, it's very important to recognize that you cannot control other people at any age. And in particular, you cannot control adults. When kids are in your home, you do have a little bit more influence over where they are, where they're going. But a part of being a parent is working yourself out of a job. That's why you teach your kids to be, you know, independent in some ways and able to care for themselves, because you are working yourself out of a job. And one of the comforts that would be helpful is for you to recognize the ways in which you have trained or taught your child to take good care of themselves. You've taught them how to, you put your daughter in kickboxing, or, you know, whatever these things are, or you know that she's not absent-minded and will pay attention to her surroundings when she's outside. You know, I don't know.
And then when something does happen, knowing that it isn't your fault, it isn't because you weren't a good enough parent, because I think parents oftentimes take on that blame when it has nothing to do with them.
Nothing at all. And that, again, is that control. We want to have a reason for stuff. So if something happens, it must be me. And sometimes bad things just happen. It's not anybody. No one is doing anything. It's just a bad thing.
How do parents set boundaries with their kids and not cater to them the way that a lot of kids expect to be catered to, and just say, I'm not picking up after you, especially when it's within their own space?
I think you just mentioned the boundaries, that while you're here, I'm not cleaning up after you. If you need assistance with something, I will wait for you to ask me. I will not give you any money that you do not have to pay back. Like, whatever those things are, you have to communicate those things to your kids. And, you know, starting early is best, because, you know, kids should already know what the boundaries are. But if they don't, if you need to implement them now, that's fine too. Perhaps some things have, you know, gone unsaid, and it's never too late to set a boundary with someone.
It is never too late to set a boundary with someone, and it is never too late to set boundaries with yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like we need to hear that often. So I've heard so many people say, it's too late for me. I'm too old. I'm too this. I'm too that.
I will be 102 and I will be setting boundaries with someone. Please put me on my side is what I might say at 102.
please make sure that you are calling me before you come into my room while I'm sleeping.
Yes, while I'm sleeping. Something, I don't know. But, you know, I think we'll always have these little things about us that people should know that would make us just feel a bit more comfortable. And we respect boundaries of other people. We do. Our parents have boundaries. Our friends have boundaries. And it's okay for us to have them. Society has boundaries. There's boundaries all around us. And we can have them too. They are not mean. Hopefully, if you are communicating them in a healthy way, they are not offensive, and you can have them.
Now we have some not so rapid fire questions. I'm very excited. This is very helpful. I'm going to sit with all of this information that you've given me, but now a little bit of fun. Okay. What is your go-to song for joy or songs?
Go-to song for joy. I really like Bobby Brown. I really like the Don't Be Cruel album, and I can't explain it to people, but I listen to Bobby Brown a lot.
good thing you don't have to explain it to people.
I'm like, I just think that was the best album ever, and I wish I was like of an age where I could have enjoyed it. If I could get into a time machine, I would go back to like 89 and be at a Bobby Brown concert. Anyways.
Ooh, wow. Okay.
I love that. I think, you know, Most Things by Beyonce, of course. I really like, I have a playlist on my phone and it's like Mary Mary and Mary J. Blige and a few other folks. And it's just fun music.
Yeah. Love that. What's the playlist called?
Spirit.
Ooh. See, I love that. That's amazing. What is your perfect peaceful moment look like?
When I am just wrapped up in a book that is so good that I don't want to put it down.
Well, that's great because the next question is, what's a book that changed how you think about something?
So many books. I can't pick one book. I refuse.
In the last year, like during quarantine, you read something and it was just like, I will never think about this thing the same way.
During quarantine. I really like The 12 Gifts by Edith Eger. I think that is a, I think it's The 12 Gifts. I really love that book, but there are so many. I'm reading like three books right now that are really good. Unwinding Anxiety. I just read Think Again, which was life-changing.
The last episode that just came out of the podcast was Adam Grant talking about Think Again. It was such a good conversation. So good.
Yeah, I like Think Again. Books that changed my life. I think my top books that I love is, I love the autobiography of Malcolm X.
That's my husband's favorite book.
It is the best book about human transformation. It is. I mean, to see him go from Malcolm Little to Detroit Red to Malcolm X to Malik El Shif, I'm like, what? What is this life he lived? You know, it was just, it's such a good story of how we can change. So I love the autobiography of Malcolm X.
Love that. Also, tomorrow night, we're doing a virtual community dinner, Community of Thought, and his daughter will be one of our speakers. So you should totally come.
Oh my gosh, please send me the information. But I will. I think that's the best book. I also like The Color Purple, and I love Their Eyes Were Watching God. But there are so many good books in the world.
We just need Nedja Tawab's book list. The Color Purple, Alice Walker's daughter, Rebecca Walker, is also on the podcast.
Oh my gosh. Okay. I need to listen to.
It's a poppin' podcast. It's a great podcast.
Yes. Yes. You know, I often think like, how is it to be the daughter of these icons?
Or well, child. The amazing thing is that they're also icons in their own right. It's so interesting that you're saying that because one of the questions that I'm going to be asking Ilyasa Shabazz tomorrow is really around how do you like separate your identity from the legacy of your parents? Mm-hmm. And also because she also is so incredible in her own right, a professor, an author, an activist, and just be your own person. And same with Rebecca Walker and Alice Walker. I did Rebecca's memoir course, and she was talking about the relationship between her and her mom and the rifts that they've had when she wrote her first memoir. She wrote her first memoir, Black, White, and Jewish. And it's just interesting because there's so many just expectations and standards. Oh, you're so-and-so's daughter before you're the person's name. It's very interesting. I love hearing people talk about that.
Yeah, yeah. I have a lot of books. I have a lot of books I want to read. At some point this year, I will be taking a vacation and what I will be doing is just reading books.
Yes. What is your reading routine? Like, how do you make sure you read all the books you want
to
read?
I listen to a ton of audiobooks. That helps so much just being able to multitask, so doing the dishes and listening to a book, folding clothes and listening to a book, like doing all of these other activities and still getting that information really helps. I make time for reading as a part of my morning routine. I read a little bit in the evenings. I love to sit on the porch and just read a book. on the weekends when I can, I'm just reading a book. So I love that. Love reading.
What are the go-to tools, the most common tools in your toolbox that you give your clients?
Go-to tools. Managing their feelings and not trying to control them. Because typically if we are in charge of controlling our feelings, we will try to get rid of them. But when we manage them by building in some practices like meditating, journaling, calling a supportive person, we can exist with those feelings a bit better. So that is my number one tool, teaching people how to manage their feelings even when they're uncomfortable and really tune into what the feeling is trying to tell them or teach them.
How do you do that? How do you listen to your feeling like that?
Well, sometimes we think feelings have no relevance. It's like, I'm so angry. But why? But why? What's coming up for you? Is it this situation? Is it something old that's adding to the anger? Is it you not being able to get your way? Really questioning yourself through the process helps you get through the feeling of anger or whatever feeling.
Mm. And finally, what do you know for sure?
What I know for sure is I will always be practicing becoming more of myself.
Mm. Until 102.
Until 102. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Nedra. How can we all be of service to you these days?
Well, I have a book, Set Boundaries, Find Peace. It is available everywhere that books are sold. I have an Instagram account where I am the most present. And I post mental health relationship content, polls and articles and different things that I think will be supportive to people.
One of my favorite Instagram accounts. I always share to other people that I think it could be helpful for. So thank you so much for all of the work that you do for free and all of the work that you put together for us. Is there a favorite bookstore people can buy your book from?
I think Bookshop is one of the best places to buy books because it supports independent booksellers. And if you have a favorite bookstore, you can probably find it on Bookshop. And if not, you can certainly call them and they will order the book.
Thank you. That's really helpful. Thank you so much, Nedra.
You're welcome.
For more Nedra Glover Tawab, you can get her book, Set Boundaries, Find Peace, wherever you get your books. Her website is nedratawab.com and, you know, my favorite Instagram account, at Nedra Tawab. Follow along and thank you so much. If you'd like to watch the video version of this podcast, it is up on YouTube or Facebook, both/Noor. And to you, our listener, I want to thank you for your listen and support. I'd love to stay connected. Here are some ways I'm telling stories these days. You can text me if you are in the US or Canada. Yes, it is me, not a bot. I also text you intentional daily questions of the day. My number is 301-246-8894. You can follow us on social, on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, and YouTube @Noor. And on Instagram @AYS. My Twitter, Snapchat, and Clubhouse is N Tagori.